So the question is, in the King case, the transaction was actually a sale for full and adequate consideration, and the appraisal said appraise for gift tax purposes. Well, why are we appraising for gift tax purposes if we've got a sale?
Well, because you want to make sure you have a sale and not a gift, because the government could take the position in a sale transaction, obviously, that there's part gift, part sale, if the consideration doesn't match up.
And they wouldn't look at, gosh, you thought there was maybe a gift.
You know, some people have said that, you know, when I talk to folks about disclosing this sale transaction in a gift tax return to start the statute of limitations running, they say, well, this is a sale, not a gift. And I say, yeah, but to get the gift tax statute started running, you need to disclose it. And that question has come up. Is this an implication that there's a gift in there somewhere? And my response to that is no, because the regs require this transaction to be disclosed adequately in the gift tax return to start the statute. It's a sale transaction. We say it's a sales transaction, but we want the statute to start running.
Well, you do it to do the non-disclosure statement. So whenever you use a King-type price adjustment clause, I think you need to follow through and do that non-gift tax disclosure statement. If you don't want to do a non-gift disclosure statement and just want to roll the dice, then don't use a price adjustment feature. Just roll the dice.
The IRS is going to have a hard time saying, well, it was a full and adequate consideration sale, therefore you didn't need to file a gift tax return, and no gift tax return was filed, so the statute didn't run, so now that we can claim it is a gift. Wait a second.
But Melissa, to your point, there will be agents out there who say it.
Do we need to make an actual gift in the year that we file a return for a non-gift?
Yeah.
Is that important or not?
I want to shift gears. Let's talk about what the situation that arises so often in practice. The will is signed the very day that the durable power of attorney is granted to a primary beneficiary under the will. And it used to be, and most of the time, we're dealing with a nuclear family. All of his kids are all also her kids, and we only got one marriage. But now that's turning out to be more the exception than the rule. And consequently, even though I talked this morning about a smell case. You knew this will was going to be. When the first will said all to these two boys, disinherit number three. But sometimes you're not really sure, but you think there's always the outside chance. How do you handle execution? We always do it that way, the will and the durable power the same day. Mickey, what do you do?
Well, in our office, we have a standard procedure, and we always sign the wills before we sign the powers of attorney. I mean, literally, we do. The documents are laid out on the table. We sign wills, then we sign statutory powers of attorney, then medical powers of attorney. So at the moment the will is signed, that child is not an agent, although they might be an agent under a prior power.
I think there's three words that are the response to that by the challenging party, and the three words are ho, ho, ho.
There really is a problem, you know, when you've got the fair-haired child who really has been caring for parent, and parent really does want to do something special for them. So what does the child do? Drives mom to see the lawyer because she needs help. And mom says, I want him sitting in the meeting so that he can explain all this to me after we leave. And naturally, I want him to be the executor of my estate, and naturally, I want him to be the agent under my power of attorney. And you're just setting him up for an undue influence claim. And, you know, we try to say, child, stay away. As the old notary rules say, I want to take her privily apart and consult with her privately about what her goals are. As Stan points out, the problem with naming that fair-haired child as an agent of the power of attorney is we've now shifted the burden of proof for him to show there was an undue influence, as opposed to the more normal case where the plaintiff would have to show that there is undue influence. And it is a problem.
Does a springing power of attorney help with that?
And so does a springing power of attorney help? He's not my agent until I become incapacitated. You know, the courts seem to, and we keep seeing this in different areas. You know, there was a case out there where they said, well, the daughter was a fiduciary even though she didn't know she was named as an agent under a power of attorney. The Texas legislature had to actually overturn that by statute. The IRS says that if you're an agent under your parents' power of attorney and they have a foreign bank account, you are liable for failure to do FBAR reporting because you have discretionary authority over a foreign account and you were supposed to report it and you didn't and you're personally liable. And so there are a lot of good attorneys are drafting powers of attorney that say, my agent doesn't have any power over my foreign accounts. Even if the client doesn't have foreign accounts, you might as well have that in there just to cut that off in case something does crop up. But this notion that as soon as I name someone as an agent in the power of attorney, you know, 500 years of fiduciary law come crushing down on their shoulders and they're burdened with all this responsibility. It's a difficult problem.
I want to hear what Catherine says about that. What do you do when you've always done this, right? Same day, same day, same day?
I do what Mickey does and have them sign the will first. But yes, I do it on the same day. And I think you made a good point that often the agents have already been serving under a prior power of attorney that the client had executed. But I do wonder whether using a springing power of attorney might help if it activates upon an incapacity event. And hopefully the day they're signing the power of attorney, they're not already incapacitated. And I don't know whether that helps, but I would like to think that it does, that they're not an agent yet. And so they don't have those fiduciary duties, hopefully.